Hey everybody, it's JT. What is on your holiday meal shopping list? Well, I would suggest Painted Hills Natural Beef. It is some of the best beef in the world. And your friends and family will be thanking you for a long time if you serve Painted Hills Natural Beef for your holiday meals. And now you can buy it online just by going to PaintedHillsBeef.com. Use the code BBQNATION at checkout and save yourself 15% on your order. Give Painted Hills Natural Beef a place on your table this holiday season.
It's time for Barbecue Nation with JT. So fire up your grill, light the charcoal, and get your smoker cooking. Now, from the Turn It, Don't Burn It studios in Portland, here's JT.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Nation. That's Barbecue Nation. I'm JT, along with Camaro Dave and Commander Chris, coming to you from the Turn It, Don't Burn It studios in Portland, Oregon. Great day. I hope everybody's being safe out there. I truly do. We'll get through this thing, as you know, you hear about it all the time, 24/7 on the news. So that's about all I'm going to say about it. This week, we've got Robert Moss. And Robert, if you follow barbecue and food at all, he writes for Southern Living, among other things. He also has a newsletter called Q-Sheet. We're going to be talking to him about all kinds of different styles of barbecue and his work and how he got into it and all that. We'd like to thank Painted Hills Natural Beef for sponsoring this part of the show, and that's Painted Hills Natural Beef, the way nature intended it. And you can check them out at PaintedHillsNaturalBeef.com. And music today, which unfortunately Robert won't be able to hear, but I pick some old TV show themes. Just having fun. My buddy James Drury from the Virginian, who I was fortunate enough to know and interview a few times over the years, passed away. And so I kind of did that for him. Anyway, Robert, welcome to the show, bud.
Oh, hey, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
No problem. By the way, just if anybody's curious about that, we'll tell you during the show how you can sign up for Robert's newsletter, the Q-Sheet. It's good stuff, and he puts it out on a weekly basis, and it's always full of good information. So anyway, what started you in all this? What started you in the world of barbecue and cooking? Start with cooking in general. Was it the way you grew up or a family thing?
Well, My mother's a really good cook, so, you know, I sort of learned to cook from her when I was getting up to college age, but, you know, not really barbecue or anything like that. You know, sure. I didn't come from a barbecuing family for sure. I grew up in Greenville, South Carolina, and I sort of got into barbecue from the academic route, which is sort of an odd way to get to it. I got a PhD in English from the University of South Carolina, and after I finished that, I'd gotten really into food history and was interested in reading a book on the history of barbecue, went to the library to check one out, and turned out no one had written a book on the history of barbecue. Yeah. So, there's just a few things written, chapters of books and stuff. So I started doing a lot of research on it and ended up writing Barbecue, the History of American Institution, which came out in 2010. And along the way, got more and more into food writing, and one thing led to another. And now I'm writing about food for all sorts of people.
So when you write about it, do you also get to go sample it all over?
Oh, absolutely. And I signed on several years ago with Southern Living as their contributing barbecue editor. And the whole idea there is that I've started traveling all around the South and visiting all, so I call them barbecue tours, trying to hit all the barbecue regions and all the states and sampling all the barbecues. And over time, I've done a series of articles on like Alabama barbecue, Tennessee barbecue, and started doing my top 50 barbecue list for them. So definitely a big part of the gig up until, about a month ago, was driving all over and eating as much barbecue as I could, which has been a lot of fun.
That's a tough job, Robert. I mean, I got to tell you, that's a tough, tough job. You probably go through a few shirts if you're like.
Definitely. Definitely a few shirts. I've wrecked a few rental cars for sure. they don't like it when I return it after, 3 days of barbecue touring, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah,
it's a great way to really experience the differences between all the American barbecue regions, that they're still so different in their character.
Oh, they are. But I was going to say about the rental car, because I've done this a few times myself. They not only pressure wash the outside of the rental car, they hit the steering wheel and the seat and the floor mats and stuff like
that. Right.
Get that.
Get the grease stains off.
Yeah, no kidding. Sure. No kidding. Well, I think when you think of Southern barbecue, and I've spent a lot of time in the South in Kentucky and in Georgia and in Texas and Louisiana and that. I mean, those are Virginia. I've spent a lot of time there and in the Carolinas. But when you think about that, I think sometimes they get kind of stereotypical thoughts in their mind. There's an old shed with some corrugated metal on the side and smoke coming out and and all that. And that is true to some degree, but not for all of them. But I think that's kind of the visual concept people have of, you know, barbecue stores, if you will, restaurants, barbecue stands alongside the road. But it's much more sophisticated than that, in a, especially in the cooking aspects. I just want your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. I mean, you still will come across every now and again some of the old school places that, you know, has a soot blackened, you know, pit out back where there, you know, just one guy who's shoveling the coals or burning wood down. But most barbecue operations these days are really sophisticated in terms of, you know, well, it all depends. You know, some are small operations.
Sure.
But the larger ones are full service kitchens, and they're, you know, they've got barbecue pits, yes, but they also have deep fryers and stoves and all that. And even the, you know, the guys who are doing hardcore wood cooking, there's still a pretty elaborate operation back there with the pit houses and the number of different pits that they have.
Well, and it takes so much time. You know, really, I mean, if they're serving brisket, for example, which different parts of the country, brisket is not the number one, you know, some parts, you know, pull is, or some parts ribs are, some parts chicken, but, you know, a lot of them have brisket as their standard. And, you know, they're lighting those fires, or they, a lot of them never let them go out, but, you know, in the, in the evening, so they can start serving at noon the next day type thing. So it's a 24/7 process.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, any of the old school operations that are doing, you know, wood cooked barbecue, they've got a crew who starts, you know, someone usually gets them started, but someone's going to come in late, you know, midnight or so, and carry it all through the night. And it is around the clock operation. And then as guys have scaled it up, like John Lewis, who's a great brisket cook here in Charleston, South Carolina, where I am, he's gotten half dozen pits and a whole operation, and he staggers it because he wants fresh meat coming off the pit at all times. Cause,
sure.
You know, in Texas, a lot of times they'll do a whole batch and then they'll sell it till it's gone. But, like Lewis is operating, he's staying up until 10 o'clock at night. So, you know, he's got a whole operation and down to a science of how they stagger when each kind of meat goes on the pit, so they can sort of anticipate demand and make sure that, you know, they always have fresh meat to carve for people.
Yeah, we're talking with Robert Moss from Southern Living, and also puts out besides being an author of some books, he does an email newsletter called The Q Sheet. We'll talk to you about how you get that a little later in the show. Yeah, I find it very interesting because I live on the West Coast, and our version of barbecue is a little different. Not so much mine, because I've traveled so much, and that's fine. But a lot of the barbecue out here is not the same as you would get in the South. And I find that interesting because sometimes when you give them, use Texas for an example, if you're going to bring real Texas barbecue up here, a lot of times people won't care for it. They like it. They like a lot of sauce out here. You know what I mean? and it's interesting to see that because, like I said, having traveled and I've eaten it at converted gas stations in Texas, which are now, you know, barbecue restaurants with pits in the back and stuff. It's different. And so that's kind of a, what do I want to say? We have a wide base across the country.
Yeah. I mean, and for sure. I think that, you know, since about 10 years ago, really, when Aaron Franklin and Austin sort of took off as this barbecue celebrity, and suddenly everybody, you know, all over the country was falling in love with brisket. For, you know, a long while, I think that Texas style of brisket sort of took over the nation. And so you're all getting, you know, really serious brisket cooks on the West Coast and up in Brooklyn and all over the place. But despite that, you still have just all these pockets of very, you know, unique kind of barbecue regions throughout the South, which still exists. So it's definitely not homogenized, even though brisket has sort of, you know, taken over the map. If you head to someplace like, around Birmingham, Alabama, and go all the great rib joints down there. That's a whole way of cooking that you won't find anywhere else, Eastern North Carolina, and go to a place like Skylight Inn or Grady's or Bee's Barbecue, where they're cooking whole hog, Eastern North Carolina style. Again, completely different from the way they cook the meat to the side dishes they serve it with, and even sort of the way the restaurants look. So it's still such a diverse and varied regional barbecue tradition.
Sure. We're going to take a break here on Barbecue Nation on the Sun Envision Radio Networks, and we're going to be back with Robert Moss right after this. Don't go away.
Moving, though they're disapproving, keep them doggies moving.
Hey, everybody, it's JT, and this is a special version of Barbecue Nation. It is brought to you in part by Painted Hills Natural Beef. Beef you can be proud to serve your family and friends. That's Painted Hills Natural Beef.
Paladin, Paladin, where do you roam?
Hey, welcome back here to Barbecue Nation Paladin, on the Sun Envision Radio Paladin Networks. I'm JT. From the Turn It, Don't Burn It studios, and today we have Robert Moss with us. If you ever read any, the books like The History of Barbecue, which Robert wrote, and is your official title the barbecue editor for Southern Living?
Yeah, I'm the contributing barbecue editor
for okay. Southern Living. All right. And he's great, and he puts a lot of work into it, and he knows what he's talking about. By the way, if you want to email us, it's barbecue, that's BBQ at salempdx.com. That's barbecue, BBQ at salempdx.com. And you can find our shows out there. I think we're on 10 or 12 now different podcast venues and streaming services after the show airs on the radio network. So we're out there. You can find us. And we want to thank you for listening. Anyway, one of the things that caught my eye when I got a hold of you to interview you, you had just written a piece about the division of sauces in South Carolina.
Oh yeah.
And mm-hmm. and then you were kind of saying, if I paraphrase this right, that you really there doesn't need to be those dividing lines anymore, but they still are. You want to go off on that for me a little bit?
Yeah, there's. If you Google anywhere South Carolina barbecue sauces, you'll probably find this map that was produced 30 or more years ago that divides South Carolina up into four sauce styles. And the idea was there's a thin tomato sauce in the northwestern part of the state, a thick tomato sauce along the sort of southwest along the Savannah River, the famous mustard, yellow mustard-based sauce in the center of the state, and the vinegar-based sauce as you get up into the what we call a PD, which is the northeastern part of the state. And that was actually compiled by two geography professors at the University of South Carolina back in the early 80s, I think. And they actually drove all around the state and, visited all these barbecue joints long before there was the internet, and they had to track them all down and
sure.
and then mapped out the sauce that they found. And so I don't doubt that was an accurate map in the early 80s. But these days, it certainly it just doesn't line up anymore to what you actually find if you visit all the barbecue joints in the state.
Well, as a barbecue historian, as one of your titles, I do want to ask you this, and this is kind of a question that's rolled over in my mind many times over the years. When you talk about the vinegar-based sauce, and we've all read about it, and there's been some theories on the history and stuff, but I'd like to ask you, what was the origins of that? Was it a particular yep. group of people that settled there 250 years ago, or what was it?
Well, it's actually an interesting history to sauce itself, because really what we think of as the regional styles of barbecue sauce today, like mustard-based sauce in the Carolinas, a sort of thick brown sweet stuff that you may find out in Memphis, and all those types of sauces are really 20th century innovations that came about through restaurants when restaurants really started developing in the 20th century. The Eastern North Carolina style barbecue sauce is pretty much the original American style barbecue sauce. So if you went back to the 19th century, long before there were restaurants and long before you had refrigeration and before you could buy cuts of meat from a butcher. Barbecue was an outdoor tradition where they would cook whole animals. It could be pigs, it could be cows, it could be goats, it could be sheep, it could be anything, on these huge long pits in the ground. And they were really these gigantic events. And if you look at the accounts of those events from back in the 19th century, almost every account that mentions barbecue sauce, it's a blend of vinegar, usually black and red pepper, and then often like melted butter or lard, and that they would use it sort of as a basting sauce while the animals were on the pit. So mm-hmm. that sort of blend of vinegar, pepper, salt is sort of the original sauce. And it wasn't until really the 20th century that people started putting ketchup in it or mustard in it or brown sugar and all those types of things. So really the East and North Carolina style used to be the American style. You can find descriptions of barbecues in Texas from the 19th century, and the basting sauce is basically identical to what you would see in the accounts in North Carolina and Virginia.
Did they come from, though? I mean, was there a European settlers came over? Was that indicative to something that came out of Germany or France or wherever? You know?
No, absolutely not. It's something very American and very unique. And, it's a little hard to pin down exactly, where barbecue came from, who originated it, because it's really a mixture of cultures coming together. So you had the Native American culture, obviously, already here.
Sure.
You had the Europeans coming. You had Africans coming or being brought over, and all sort of mixing together in the colonial days. But it's pretty clear that the Native Americans were cooking or smoking and cooking animals over this rack. That is where we get the word barbecue and the Spanish word barbacoa comes from.
Yeah.
It was the term for the cooking rack. And there's this really interesting English parody piece almost, or humor piece. It was written in the early 18th century. And it's a British writer and a bunch of Englishmen are staging a barbecue in Peckham, England, just south of London. And what's interesting about it is how they distinguish what makes it an American style barbecue. Part of it is the fact that the animals are cooked whole, and part of it is that they're basting the animals with this blend of Madeira wine and vinegar and pepper, based on with a fox's tail. And so that's a very un-English way of cooking.
Yeah, it's got flavor to it.
Yeah, that's right. It's not just turning something on a spit, because people have been cooking meat over fire forever.
Sure.
But there's something unique about doing it up on that grid, up above the coals or the fire, and then basting it with that sauce. That really seemed like a very un-English way to cook an animal. And so where it came from in the colonies, not exactly sure. It's sort of this convergence of cultures, but certainly that basting sauce has its roots all the way back there in the 18th century.
No, I find it very interesting, and I'm the crack about because it tastes better than English food. I mean, now we've got quite a few barbecue restaurants outside of London and in some of the boroughs there.
All over England, all over Europe. I just recently interviewed a bunch of folks from Australia who are opening American style barbecue restaurants in Australia. So it's taken the globe for sure in the past, 10 or 20 years.
Oh, no doubt about that, man. I've been to Australia a couple, three times, and each time, sometimes they had me cook, which was fine and fun because I probably was the one that was the most sober at the minute, to do it. But they enjoy it down there. Robert and I are going to take a break. We're going to be back here on Barbecue Nation on the network in just a few minutes. Don't go away.
Paladin, Paladin, where do you roam?
Hey, everybody, it's JT, and this is a special version of Barbecue Nation. It is brought to you in part by Painted Hills Natural Beef. Beef you can be proud to serve your family and friends. That's Painted Hills Natural Beef. Welcome back to Barbecue Nation. I'm JT. Today we're talking with Robert F. Moss from Southern Living, from the Cue Sheet, from his tomes that he's written about drinking, or drink, I should say, in the What was the title of that book? I'm sorry, I didn't print it out in front of me, but I was...
That's actually my most recent book. It's Southern Spirits, 400 Years of Drinking in the American South.
There you go.
With recipes. So it really tells the story of spirits in the South from Jamestown all the way up till today with lots of fun stories and a few recipes sprinkled in so you can sample things along the way.
Okay, so this isn't particularly about barbecue, but who invented the mint julep?
That is actually another very long question, but the short answer is not Kentuckians, and the original juleps did not contain bourbon. You can get the full story in the book if you're interested in it.
Yeah.
The julep actually emerges out of the colonial era, originally made with rum and then with peach or apple brandy were sort of the original spirits for it. And Virginia in the 1830s, 1840s, Virginia was the home of the julep. The great julep makers lived there and in these hotel bars and in the hot spring resorts up at the edge of the mountains of Virginia. During the summertime, a big julep with lots of ice, usually made with rum or brandy, sugar and mint and plenty of fruits, was like this the star of these great resorts. It was only much later that... it started being made with bourbon and they started, serving it in Kentucky, where of course the Kentucky Derby made it famous. But, that was some 50 years after the Virginians were famous for their juleps.
I got to tell you, every year on Kentucky Derby Day, my dad would make mint juleps and I never particularly liked them. I'm a Scotch guy, so I'm, sorry to disappoint people, but that's the truth. But that's the only time he ever made them though.
I think that's the only time most people will ever have a julep, and which is a shame. But if you make them, I really like them with cognac, which is how a lot of them were also made in the 19th century. I think it's a far superior. I'd rather just sip my bourbon neat and drink a julep with something else.
Yeah, no, I can still drink bourbon, but it's like you, I got to have it neat or maybe with one or two ice cubes in it, but not in a lot of mix or anything. Every time I mix stuff, I end up in a wreck, so to speak. So, and you know what I'm talking about. And so do the listeners. So let's go back to your growing up, Robert. Do you have a favorite memory of a family food? And I always ask all of my guests this, especially authors, because, we all have different, we come from different backgrounds. We come from different familial circles. So do you have something that stuck out in your mind that said, man, I love this on Sunday dinners or something?
I do remember Sunday dinner in particular. That was always a big meal with my family. And, my mother would usually start cooking before we went to church, and then we would go to church and she'd have it in the oven or whatever. And you'd come back and you'd be hungry because it's really a long service and you're ready, and you would just walk in the door and the whole house smells like food. So I no particular dish, but just like, and she would always do roasts and things like that. So that's definitely a Sunday dinner was a big food memory for me.
Yeah. I remember those Sunday, like you said, roasts, the pot roasts or chucks or whatever they were, whatever we could afford at the time. And
it was always mashed potatoes and gravy and all the good things that go with a roast.
Yeah, green beans or corn or something. There was always a salad or two there and some sides. Those were great dinners. Great dinners. I loved them. So in comparison, when you wrote a book on the history of barbecue and you're a food historian technically, and so all of that, how have we progressed? Have we gotten better? Which is kind of a loaded question. I understand that. But have we drifted too far away from the original barbecue that was developed out of necessity over time?
We're actually in what I would call sort of the second golden age of barbecue. In my barbecue history, I call the 1940s and 1950s the golden age of barbecue. Because that was really before fast food restaurants, before McDonald's had really taken off. And in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, barbecue was like the premier American restaurant food. You could get it in little, roadside stands. You get it downtown street corners. You could get it at like these fancy restaurants that served steaks and chops would have a barbecue pit in the back where they were cooking over wood. And so that's when so many of the sort of legendary barbecue joints that we think of today were founded. They were founded back in the 40s and the 50s. So there's, you know, cooking on all wood pits and doing it the old school way. It really went way, way downhill starting in really the 1960s and 70s. You had the rise of the McDonald's and Burger King's and the fast food chain,
sure,
which just sort of drove the low and slow barbecue wasn't very profitable. Wood got very expensive in the 70s, and you know, so it's already a low margin business. And a lot of restaurants are switching over to gas pits, and gas pits without a trace of wood. They're not like the modern combo cookers that you have today that are really good. So it's really almost disappeared in the 80s, but then it started coming back. And what I think these days is there's so many talented, ambitious young pit masters who have gotten into the business in the last 10 years. A few come from old barbecue families, but a lot come from just all over from other walks of life, but have fallen in love with barbecue. And they're hardcore about it. I mean, they've seriously studied traditions. They are very passionate about using wood and using pits and doing it the sort of, you know, I don't like the word artisanal, but
yeah,
you can sort of call it that. It's really treating it like a craft with respect and in a way that we almost lost at a point in our history. So I don't think we've gotten too far away from it. I think we're coming back now toward where we were, and we're almost in the 10 years since I wrote the barbecue history. I finished that book with a sort of mildly hopeful chapter talking about how it looked like barbecue has almost lost to history, and now it's starting to come back and maybe we'll be okay. But then boom, it's just taken off, and now barbecue is just everywhere. And
yes,
there's so many good barbecue restaurants now, and so many talented cooks and festivals and events where you can enjoy barbecue. It's really come back a lot.
You know, I find it kind of interesting because I love barbecue. Obviously I wouldn't be doing this show, right? And but the one thing that I can always tell, and you can throw your two cents in on this, and I'm more than happy to listen to it, because I think you know what I'm talking about here. You can always tell when somebody opens a new barbecue business, especially out here, and the biggest problem they have is consistency with the cook, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And not the human cook, the actual endeavor of cooking that piece of meat, whatever it is. And I think that kills more new barbecue businesses than anything. Because, you know, restaurant business is a tough business. But that being said, the difference is when I come back to your neck of the woods or in Texas or someplace like that, and I stop by a seasoned, pardon the pun, barbecue business, I pretty much know what I'm going to get. You know, and that's why I stopped there, because I liked it, or I want to experiment with something that's a little different. But I think that's a problem, not a big one, but that's the things you need to learn to be successful. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I would 100% agree with that. And consistency is one of the toughest things in barbecue. You know, if you're cooking on a wood-fired pit and you're actually feeding it with wood and coals, it's like consistency of temperature, trying to keep it at that same temperature, having these wild swings up and down can really damage the meat. Or if you're using something more like a old hickory or southern pride, where you can sort of set the temperature there, that takes care of that temperature consistency. But then what you do with the meat once you take it off the pit, how long you rest it, how you wrap it. Barbecue joints who refrigerate meat and then reheat it, that can always be very problematic.
Oh,
and
sure.
It can lead to, like, you know, if you've ever had ribs that were wrapped and stored overnight and then reheated the next day, you know it. And that consistency is, I think, really what, you know, I do this top 50 barbecue list every year for Southern Living. And that's really what has made, you know, I've tried to visit all, I've visited all the restaurants on there multiple times. So I try to go back, so as often as I can, at least once every 2 years for each restaurant, and all off the list have done so primarily because I'd go back once and just have a really bad meal, and maybe you have a really great slab of ribs next time you're there. But if you're not, you know, if you're not consistent day in, day out, then the other guy's going to win out over you.
Hey, we're going to take a break here on Barbecue Nation. We're going to come back with Robert Moss, talk about his newsletters and some more barbecue thoughts right after this. Hey, everybody, it's JT, and this is a special version of Barbecue Nation. It is brought to you in part by Painted Hills Natural Beef. Beef you can be proud to serve your family and friends. That's Painted Hills Natural Beef. Welcome back to Barbecue Nation. I'm JT here in the Turn and Don't Burn It Studios, and we're talking with Robert Moss here. Robert's got the newsletter, the Q Sheet. Tell us about, why did you start that?
That's a good question. I always wanted to do something like that. You know, I have my regular columns that I do for Southern Living that run online. I do a lot of print features, but I didn't really have a way to sort of do barbecue news and just have observations and you know, all these sort of small little bits that may only be a paragraph or two long. I really, you know, I collect all these things as I was doing my research and decided a newsletter would be a great way to do it. And, you know, it lets something you connect directly, lets me connect directly with readers who are interested. But it's also, it keeps me honest because I'm always now looking for things for the cue sheet. And particularly, I do a thing called Burnt Ends where I always try to find whatever, you know, sort of comical, humorous barbecue item of the week.
Sure.
So I have fun doing that. And so it just seemed like a good outlet that lets me use up a lot of material that I may not be able to use elsewhere, you know, maybe it's a smaller format and have fun with it, you know, do it my own sort of my own style.
Well, it's a fun newsletter. I look forward to it now. I've only been a subscriber for a month or so, but, you know, I've gotten several of them and I really enjoy what you put in there. How can people find it?
Well, the easiest way is to go to my website, which is robertfmoss.com. And you'll see right on the front page there where you can sign up for it. And it's just a simple online sign up. And I do it every Sunday, so it comes out sometime Sunday afternoon. And we'll just go to your email inbox and deliver up some fresh barbecue bites every week.
I think it's fun, and I think it's great. And even though, like, you know, people on my side of the country don't, sometimes you're talking about more regional and local stuff back in your neck of the woods, and it's still fun to read about it. And It makes it very interesting. And the other thing it should do to people is open their eyes about how big, of course, we talked about it in the show, but how big the barbecue business is, especially in the South. It's huge.
Yeah, it's huge and seems to be getting bigger every year. I've been thinking every year for the last 10 years that, well, barbecue sort of, it's got to reach its peak. The bubble's about to burst and everybody's going to move on to, you know, chicken sandwiches or something, but it hasn't yet. It just seems to get more and more popular every year.
No, I think you're right. And we see more of them out here. And I can just tell you from the listener base to this show that has expanded. Of course, we're across the country now and the syndication is still ongoing for this show, but we get emails from new people every week saying, hey, you know, what about this or what about that? And I try to direct them to places. I certainly can cook and do all this stuff, but I'd rather send them to people like yourself for information or Meathead or somebody like that. Probably more articulate than I would be because they say, how do you tell when it's done? And I'll usually say, when it's done, you know, something smart ass like that.
Yeah. You sort of know it when it feels like it's done. Not terribly helpful when you're first starting out.
No. Real quick, last question probably for the regular show here. What inspires you to pick a subject or a topic to write about when you're doing about the barbecue world?
That's a good question. It's usually anything that's sort of newsworthy or unusual always strikes my attention. I just did a piece for Southern Living on the sort of resurgence or the emergence of South Carolina-style barbecue hash in Texas. And so something like that catches my attention because hash and rice, and people in the West Coast probably never even heard of such a thing. It's the staple barbecue side dish here in South Carolina, sort of like this meat gravy that's cooked down for hours and hours and served over white rice. And everybody who comes to South Carolina looks at it and says, what the heck is that? But all of a sudden, these guys in Texas are making it, which, you know, the place that has never seen hash before. And it's sort of connected to the fact that they're starting to cook whole hogs in Texas. A number of people are starting to do that, which is more of a Carolina style of cooking.
Right.
So that just caught, struck my eyes. Oh, well, that's unusual. That's something different, and wrote a piece of it. So I'm usually looking for something that is either a little bit out of the ordinary, or a lot of times it's me exploring regions. I did a piece on barbecue in Tampa, the Tampa area, not too long ago, because I was traveling down there. And, you know, it's just not an area that a lot of people think of as barbecue. So I really tried to sort of take in the town and get a feel for the barbecue culture. And they're doing some really interesting things down in Tampa. So, again, that's that twist of sort of the unexpected things in barbecue, I think, is what usually draws my eye.
There you go. Robert Moss, Southern Living, robertfmoss.com, if you want to sign up for his newsletter, or check out his books, too. I am going to have to get the Southern Drinking book. I am. I didn't get that one, so I'm going to have to get that, Robert.
Yeah, that's a fun one, too. A lot of probably unexpected things in there. There's a lot more to drinking in the South, than I think, than just mint juleps, I'll tell you that.
That I know for a fact, my friend. That I know for a fact. Robert's going to stick around and be on the after-hour show, but for the rest of us, we got to get out of here. So I'd like to thank Dave and Chris, and remember our motto here, turn it, don't burn it, and we'll be back. For those of you who have another hour coming up, we've got more fun in the next hour, and for those not, we'll see you next week. Take care, everybody.
Barbecue Nation is produced by JTSD LLC Productions in association with Envision Networks and Salem Media Group. All rights reserved.